of community radio and those who want to be. Everyone's welcome on this program, even those who are unprogrammable. Pretty soon, DTMM will be marking its 7th anniversary, a feat these feet never thought possible. But here we are, with no intention of quitting for at least another 15 years, when I shall receive a telegram from the Queen, if she's still reigning, or perhaps her successor, to celebrate the occasion of a century of birthdays. Today in South Africa, it is Regina Mundi Day. Latin Regina Mundi, meaning Queen of the World. In 1997, President Nelson Mandela established November the 30th as the official day to honor the church in Soweto, an urban area of black people within the city of Johannesburg, where the anti-apartheid movement got its beginnings and support. Meetings in public places were banned, so this sacred meeting place was an important link in the battle of black equality against white supremacy. The huge sanctuary holds up to 7,000 people and is often referred to as the People's Church or Cathedral. I'm not one to honor the Roman Catholic Church, however, this architectural giant became a giant in the struggle against apartheid, which was eventually won, but remains a struggle still. Excuse me. The church also has become a tourist attraction. When apartheid officially ended, Truth and Reconciliation Commission meetings were held at this location. A bit of controversial humor occurred when Bill and Hillary Clinton, who were not Catholic, visited and took communion here. However, the sermon of the day centered on adultery at the time when Clinton was involved in the Monica Lewinsky scandal and impeachment process, so he might have been excused for squirming in his pew. Pew. This is the Bird Dog, your genial host of DTMM and Mr. Fix-It, who is patiently and quietly attending the soundboard and controls in an attempt to maintain a modicum of decorum amongst the quorum. Note the rhyme. I'm sure most of you have seen the news item that the BC Provincial Legislature is the first Canadian jurisdiction to table a vote to adopt the UNDRIP. I'm fairly certain it will pass. UNDRIP is the acronym for the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Premier John Horgan had this to say about the act. This bill is critically important because Indigenous rights are human rights. We all want to live in a province where the standard of living for Indigenous peoples is the same as every other human being in the province. The legislative gallery was filled to overflowing as Indigenous leaders from across BC and the rest of Canada gathered for this historic occasion. Jody Wilson-Raybould and Romeo Saganash were also in attendance, plus the four Indigenous MLAs from BC and other federal MPs and provincial MLAs. This legislation moves us away from a relationship of denial, said Cheryl Casimir, a First Nations Summit political executive. Denial of our rights, denial of our title, denial of our basic human rights, and puts us in a position where we can sit as equal decision maker at tables where decisions are being made that impact our lives. The bill passed first reading. What this declaration does is now recognize that Indigenous peoples have the inherent right to self-government and to make decisions and have power, said Ed John, an advocate for Indigenous rights for communities in Canada and internationally. When Canada endorsed UNDRIP at the UN Assembly in New York, there was a standing ovation. Most unusual behavior on the part of all the United Nations of the world. And we are going to listen to a song now, which is a Canadian Native collaboration with Alvin Epp, who wrote the initial lyrics, and Clifton Fred, John Bell, and female vocalist Morgan Lilly. The impetus was how the Canadian government would deal with the issues of residential schools, the missing women, and the Truth and Reconciliation. Healing from the past and positive change for the future. Many of the matters reflected in the lyrics were experienced by the authors and composers. The words are important. The title is Our Lives. When I was running the Highway of Tears west of Prince George, especially the year I ran to Anchorage, Alaska every 2 weeks, I would pass the mournful empty shell of the residential school at Fraser Lake, looming like a ghost day and night. And I confess, when I thought of the atrocities that took place in this hellish structure, my face would begin to leak. The Highway of Tears, Highway 16, from Prince George to Prince Rupert, also known as the Yellowhead, has witnessed estimates of from 16 to 40 women and girls, mostly indigenous, who have been found dead or missing. Here is a 9-minute CBC documentary of an ex-RCMP officer who is investigating the disappearance and murders of these tragic events alone and on his own time. His name is Ray Michalko.
I remember once counting the number of side roads that a killer could drive off to dispose of a body in an hour, and there were, you know, 100 and or more. It'd be very easy to dispose of somebody and very difficult to find them. It's a perfect place to go missing forever.
Ray Michalko is trying to solve the murders along BC's infamous Highway of Tears. Ray used to be an RCMP officer, but after 9 years, he left the force to work on his own. Now he's a private investigator, but nobody's paying him to look into these cases. He just can't help it.
I'm disappointed that some of these cases haven't been solved. I'm stubborn. I'm not a quitter. And, you know, I like to help people.
On this day, Ray takes me back to the very beginning, to the spot where he first started his investigation 10 years ago. This abandoned elementary school in Prince George.
So what do you come here and what do you think about?
Well, this is where my first theory started, because Leah Germain's body was found dumped behind the school. It seems like a bizarre place to leave somebody if you're just driving down the highway like a stranger. So I'm still convinced that whoever was responsible is familiar with this area.
So that's Ray's working theory. The killer lived somewhere very close to here.
Would you show me? Can we walk?
Sure.
It's terrible to imagine that this is the place where Leah Germain, just a kid 15 years old, was left after she was stabbed to death. That was December 1994. How she ended up in this field is one of the things that Ray has spent years trying to figure out. He now thinks Leah's case is linked to another murdered young woman, 15-year-old Roxanne Tiara.
You know, both were murdered. Both were involved in drugs and prostitution. Both had said that they wanted to get out of it and clean up their act.
So what does it make you wonder?
Well, it makes me wonder if the people responsible for running that business,
like their
using
pimps,
them like their pimps, had something to do with it.
Do you know who the pimp was in those days?
I don't. I'm attempting to find that out, actually.
Of course, that's easier said than done. Remember, these murders happened more than 20 years ago. The other challenge is that Ray lives in Vancouver. To investigate, he has to travel north almost 800 kilometers, and he does this every chance he gets.
Have you got a minute?
Ray believes the murders can be solved with what he calls old-fashioned police work, talking to as many people as he can until somebody gives up a clue.
Excuse me.
We've agreed to conceal the name of the person Ray's looking for.
I'm that PI that's looking into the missing women, and I'm trying to find a guy by the name of...
Never heard of him.
Never heard of him? I'm trying to find a guy by the name of... You ever heard of him? Yeah?
I know him, but I haven't seen him.
You know, how about I give you a card? If you see him, you can tell him to phone me.
Ray figures he's worked a year, full-time, on these cases.
Ray.
So it's no wonder he's attracted the attention of the RCMP, the police force he used to work for.
The RCMP are very territorial, and I'm sticking my nose in what they see as their business. I would have felt the same back in the day myself.
What do you think they want you to do?
Go home and forget about it.
Okay.
I'm trying to find a guy by the name of Billy Henry. He would have been around here for quite a while.
No, I don't want him working.
I have no idea. But I know.
You got my card if he...
Here's the thing I can't stop thinking about as I follow Ray around Prince George. He doesn't have the protection of a badge. He's all alone.
Thanks.
And these are murders he's trying to solve. Ray's sticking his neck out.
I know many of the times I'm up here working, I'm out alone. Where exactly, nobody knows. So if I go missing, that's it, I'm gone as well. So I'm very careful about where I go and what time of night and who's around me and is anybody following me back to my motel and that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah?
I'm trying to find a guy by the name of... You know him?
No, I don't.
No? Well, keep my card. If you happen to hear of him, maybe he could call me. You could call me.
Okay.
Yep. Good. Thank you.
Sometimes it has to feel almost pointless. Of the 18 missing or murdered women linked to the Highway of Tears, only one single case has ever been solved. Most families still search for answers, and so does Ray. For instance, the murder of Ramona Wilson is one that Ray worked hard on but was never able to crack. Over the years, he's grown close to Ramona's sister, Brenda.
Hey.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Long time no see.
You guys still hear from the police at all? Or
they're still say they're on the case, so, and they're still investigating, but if there's no leads, then it's pretty much not a priority, so it's disheartening to the families.
The RCMP also investigated Ramona Wilson's murder. In fact, 10 years ago, they started a task force to see if there's a serial killer operating on the Highway of Tears. Multi-million-dollar budget, 70 dedicated officers. With almost no results, it's now been cut to the bone.
They called me. They said we can no longer move forward with Ramona's case. I just remember crying all the way there because it was just like, how could you do this, like, over the phone? Like, you can even come to me in person and tell me this.
I mean, I still believe there's people out there that know something. It's just getting them to come forward is a big problem.
Forward and, you know, trying to find hope in...
The police have said that Ramona's not a priority, so is Ray your last hope then?
Ray's been a really good, you know, friend to us and has inspired us in some different ways when we did feel hopeless. You know, when we figured there was no hope, that no one's out there to help us anymore. But he all seems to show up when we, you know, when we feel that way, and it's been good.
Hopefully something will happen that's good news. Anyway, I'm going to take off.
Okay. Thank you, Ray. Take care.
I try to stay focused and look at this from the point of a view of an investigator. And that's not to get emotionally involved and just to try to follow the leads.
But in the end, it does affect your heart.
Well, sure it does. It can't help, you know, and you can't shut out everything else that's going on. So it does affect you.
It's because Ray cares so much about these cases that he's right back at it. And good thing, too. Because in the end, he gets something. A possible lead.
Is
he your cousin? You got a phone number for him? Could I give you my card and maybe you could ask him to call me?
I did learn some things today. I think it went well.
What'd you learn?
I don't want to say. But I have. I've learned some things which in the future are going to help me. You know.
It could be that Ray will never figure out what happened here, but his investigations are also a reminder. There are hundreds of cases of missing or murdered Indigenous women across the country that need to be solved. Nick Purden, CBC News, Prince George, British Columbia.
So
sigh. I agonized over whether to read the chronology of events of genocide in Canada against the Indigenous peoples, but I deem it an important document for every citizen of Canada to be aware and attempt to put themselves in the place of these beleaguered human individuals. So here goes. It's a bit long, so I'll not dawdle and comment too much along the way. It is what it is. In 1857, the Gradual Civilization Act is passed by the legislature of Upper Canada, permanently disenfranchising all Indian and Métis peoples and placing them in a separate, inferior legal category than citizens. 1874, the Indian Act is passed in Canada's Parliament, incorporating the inferior social status of Native people into its language and provisions. Aboriginals are henceforth imprisoned on reserve lands and are legal wards of the state. 1884, legislation is passed in Ottawa, creating a system of state-funded, church-administered Indian residential schools. 1905, over 100 residential schools are in existence across Canada, 60% of them run by the Roman Catholics. 1907, Dr. Peter Bryce, medical inspector for the Department of Indian Affairs, tours the residential schools of Western Canada and British Columbia and writes a scathing report on the criminal health conditions there. Bryce reports that Native children are being deliberately infected with diseases like tuberculosis and are left to die untreated as a regular practice. He cites an average death rate of 40% in the residential schools. November the 15th, 1907, Bryce's report is quoted in the Ottawa Citizen's headline. 1908-1909, Duncan Campbell Scott, Superintendent of Indian Affairs, suppresses Bryce's report and conducts a smear and cover-up campaign regarding its findings. Bryce is expelled from the civil service. November 1910, a joint agreement between the federal government and the Roman Catholic, Anglican, Presbyterian, and Methodist churches establishes the structure of Indian residential schools and the contractual obligations of churches running them. Duncan Campbell Scott refers to the policy of the government as that of seeking a final solution to the Indian problem. May 1919, despite an escalating death rate of Indian children in residential schools from tuberculosis, in some cases as high as 75%, Duncan Campbell Scott abolishes the post of medical inspector for Indian residential schools. Within 2 years, deaths due to tuberculosis have tripled in residential schools. 1920, federal legislation makes it mandatory for every Indian child to be sent to residential schools upon reaching 7 years of age. Many children were kidnapped without their parents' knowledge and sent off to residential schools. At least 50,000 of these boys and girls never returned to their homes. 1928, Sexual Sterilization Act is passed in Alberta, allowing any inmate of a Native residential school to be sterilized upon the approval of only the school principal. At least 3,500 Indian women are sterilized under this law. 1933, an identical Sexual Sterilization Act is passed in British Columbia. Two major sterilization centers are established by the United Church of Canada on the West Coast in Bella and Nanaimo, in which thousands of Native men and women are sterilized by missionary doctors until the 1980s. My mother's hero, Dr. George Darby, a surgeon at the Bella Bella Hospital, was alleged to have performed 2,000 sterilizations on Native girls alone, with only the school principal's permission. 1933, residential school principals are made the legal guardians of all Native students under the oversight of the Federal Department of Mines and Resources. Every native parent is forced by law to surrender legal custody of their children to the principal, a church employee, or face imprisonment. In 1938, attempt by the federal government to close all residential schools and incorporate Indian children into public schools is defeated by pressure brought by the Roman Catholic and Protestant church leaders. 1946, Project Paperclip, a CIA program utilizing ex-Nazi researchers in medical, biological warfare, and mind control experiments, uses Native children from Canadian residential schools as involuntary test subjects under agreements with the Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches. These illegal tests continue until the 1970s. 1948 to 1969, offshoot programs of Project Paperclip are established in United Church and government hospitals in Nanaimo, Brandon Lake, Sardis, Bella Bella, Vancouver, and Victoria, British Columbia, and in Red Deer and Ponoka, Alberta, and at the Lakehead Psychiatric Hospital in Thunder Bay, Ontario. All of these programs use Native children abducted from reserves, foster in residential schools, with the full knowledge of church, police, and Indian Affairs officials. 1969, Indian Affairs Minister Jean Chrétien tables his white paper in Parliament, which reaffirms the assimilationist policy of the past century that denies sovereignty and equal status to Native nations. As a token gesture, Chrétien assigns a limited control over Indian education to local state-funded band councils. Many residential schools are phased out altogether or simply taken over by band councils. 1984, the last Indian residential school is closed in northern British Columbia. Okay, let's take a pause to say that you are listening to CKUS FM 93.7, The Voice, your choice, and this is DTMM with a different twist this morning. I did mention my sadness when trucking the Highway of Tears, so we did talk about driving through my memories. In 1990, state-funded leaders of the Assembly of First Nations discuss abuses in residential schools for the first time publicly. 1994 to 1995, eyewitnesses to murders at the United Church's Alberni Residential School speak out publicly from the pulpit of the United Church in Port Alberni. The minister is summarily fired without cause within a month and is expelled from the United Church ministry without due process during 1996. In February of that year, the first class action lawsuit of Alberni residential school survivors is brought against the United Church of Canada and the federal government. The church responds with a countersuit and an attempted gag order, which fails. 1996 to 97, further evidence of murder, sterilizations, and other atrocities at coastal residential schools are documented by Native activists in public forums in Vancouver. The number of lawsuits brought against the churches and government by residential school survivors climbs to over 5,000 across Canada. June 12 to 14, 1998, the first independent tribunal into Canadian residential schools is convened in Vancouver by IRAM, that's the International Human Rights Association of American Minorities, an affiliate of the United Nations. Evidence is submitted by dozens of Aboriginal witnesses to crimes against humanity. The tribunal concludes that the government of Canada and the Catholic, United, and Anglican churches are guilty of complicity in genocide and recommends to the United Nations that a war crimes investigation be held. 1998-99, under strong pressure from the government of Canada, the United Nations refuses to act on IRAM's recommendation. Further evidence of reports of genocide in residential schools is blacked out of the mainstream media across Canada. a concerted smear and misinformation campaign is launched by the United Church and the RCMP against efforts to document and expose genocidal practices by church and state in Canada. October 1998, the Vancouver province reports the admission of United Church lawyers that their church has engaged in a joint cover-up with the federal government of crimes committed at its Alberni Indian Residential School since at least 1960. January 1999, the New Internationalist magazine in Great Britain reports the findings of the IRAM Tribunal, including the evidence of murder in Canadian residential schools, but is subsequently threatened and silenced by United Church and Canadian government lawyers. February 2000, the number of lawsuits brought by residential school survivors climbs to over 10,000. The federal government includes or introduces legislation limiting the number of such lawsuits. It also announces that it will assume primary financial responsibility both for residential school damages and the legal expenses of the churches which ran the schools, despite the fact that Canadian courts have ruled that the churches bear either a majority or an equal responsibility for crimes at those schools. April 2000, the Federal Health Department admits that it used Native children from four residential schools, including Port Alberni, in medical experiments during the 40s and 50s, including the deliberate denial of vitamins and dental care to these children to study the effects. That was written in the Vancouver Sun, April 26, 2000. In August of 2000, the Truth Commission into Genocide in Canada is formed in Vancouver by 48 Native and non-Native activists. Its mandate is to carry on the work of the IRAM Tribunal and bring charges of genocide against churches, the RCMP, and the Government of Canada. February 2001, the Truth Commission publishes its six-year study of genocide in Canada, Hidden from History, the Canadian Holocaust. A second edition is published in June. Efforts by the United Church to legally prevent its publication fail. September, October 2001, judicial decisions in British Columbia and Manitoba deny the claims of residential school survivors that genocide was practiced and absolve the churches of any direct responsibility for damages and block any future lawsuits from claims older than 30 years, when most residential schools were closed more than 30 years ago. October 2001, new eyewitnesses come forward with firsthand evidence that Native children are being used in West Coast pedophile rings involving senior judges, politicians, church, and Aboriginal leaders. One of these pedophile networks operates out of the prestigious Vancouver Club. December 15, 2001, the Roman Catholic Church discloses that it hired a known and convicted sex offender and murderer, Martin Saxe, to work as a dormitory supervisor at its Christie Indian Residential School in Tofino, B.C. during the 1960s. Saxe subsequently raped and terrorized children at this school without ever being reprimanded or prosecuted. April 27, 2002, the first television documentary featuring eyewitnesses to murders in Canadian Indian residential schools is broadcast in Vancouver on CTV's First Story program. The show aired simultaneously in Winnipeg, Toronto, and Halifax. Native survivors of genocide give their stories. On the same program, United Church official Brian Thorpe admits for the first time that criminal actions occurred in his church's residential schools. July 22, 2002, a gag order in the form of a defamation lawsuit is brought by the Government of Canada through its paid agent, Chief Edward John of the state-funded First Nations Summit. The lawsuit seeks an injunction banning anyone from discussing the allegation of secret land deals, murder, drug trafficking, and pedophilia made against Chief John and other state-funded Native chiefs by members of his own tribal council, Frank Martin and Helen Michelle. Chief John's lawsuit is handled by Queen's Counsel Marvin Storrow of Blake, Castles and Graydon Law Firm in Vancouver. Storrow is a personal friend and legal counsel to Prime Minister Jean Chrétien. August 22, 2002, the lawsuit goes ahead and Ed John wins his injunction in the British Columbia Supreme Court. The injunction is granted by the same judge, James Taylor, who, on behalf of the Law Society of BC, helped disbar lawyer Jack Cram in April 1994 after Cram had made allegations concerning possible pedophilia, corruption among judges and politicians in BC involving Native children. October 2002, the allegations against Ed John and the conflict of interest Judge Taylor continue. October 18, 2002, a restraining order is issued by Judge Taylor, who also bans Native eyewitnesses Frank Martin and Helen Michelle from discussing their evidence about Ed John and strikes their statements from all BC court records. Judge Taylor also indicates his intention to seek a banning of the histories on genocide in Canada, hidden from history, the Canadian Holocaust. November 1, 2002, Love and Death in the Valley is published by First Books in the United States. Acting for Ed John, lawyer Marvin Storrow tries to prevent its publication, but fails. Early December 2002, an all-party parliamentary meeting in Ottawa discusses hidden from history the Canadian Holocaust and hashes over how to deal with all the natives who are starting to talk about murders in residential schools, according to a source who was present. December 14, 2002, a sheriff from the Port Coquitlam Office of the Attorney General attempts to serve court documents but fails. The documents are reported to be either a summary arrest warrant or a more severe restraining order. In December of 18, 2002, a spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva confirms that the commissioner will probably be sending an official investigator to Canada in the spring of 2003 to examine evidence of crimes against humanity committed against Native peoples. She confirms that Prime Minister Jean Chrétien could theoretically be summoned to publicly answer charges of complicity in genocide. December 28, 2002, radio station in Los Angeles airs the story about genocide in Canada and is heard by an audience of over 2 million people. There you have it, folks, to the end of 2002. Now, most of you know what has been taking place since 2003 with the Truth and Reconciliation Process, which was held in most communities across Canada and was completed in 2015. The current protests for the MMIWG, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, continues, and rightly so. It ain't over yet. Not one person, church, government, or police has yet been arrested or held accountable for the horror that were termed the final solution of the Native peoples. Here's another original song by Daryl Dawslow, who, when he went out to the park in Saskatoon to take part in National Indigenous Peoples Day in 2016, a little Indigenous girl sat down next to him on his longboard. Dawslow found her so endearing that he asked her parents if he could take a picture of her in her rainbow face paint, and the image was so touching for him that it became a lyric in It Is Ours, the song he wrote about reconciliation in Canada, which we are about to hear. It seemed to offer a picture of hope, this little person who was completely oblivious to the fact that my forefathers were the bad guys in her forefathers' story, Dawslow said. It didn't matter to innocence. It didn't matter to the face of hope. Doslow grew up in Kamloops, B.C., and said he didn't know that there had been a residential school located there until he was 50 years old and didn't live in the city anymore. That's how much it's been suppressed. Now an elementary school art teacher in Saskatoon, he said it was one of the many things he's had to come to grips with as an adult and a defining experience that motivated him to put the song together. I think that reconciliation is a handshake in the dark. You reach out your hand and you don't really know how it will be received, he said. You just know in this moment that you need to extend your hand and hope for the best. Daryl Paskeman, a Plains Cree drummer and a flute player with experience in the music industry, met Doslow while Paskeman was working with children to teach them about aspects of Indigenous culture. Paskeman said he was moved by Doslow's lyrics and considered the project a good step toward bringing more awareness to reconciliation in Canada. His mother was a residential school survivor, so he understands how important reconciliation is for the country. He said 19-year-old Métis sound engineer Jasmine Durocher, who put together the final mix, and Indigenous videographer Jessica Sisakwasis, whose grandparents met while attending residential school, said she didn't really know what Doslow's song was about when one of her instructors asked to make the music video on the project. But after hearing the song and watching Doslow get overcome with emotion while in the booth, she understood what he was trying to do. I was so blown away, she said. The whole production of the song is very beautiful. It all fits perfectly. I immediately fell in love with it. It made me really inspired. It's probably the hardest I've ever worked on a mix. Here it is. It Is Ours by Daryl Doslow. Again, the words.
In 2016, I read the Truth and Reconciliation Commission summary report and wrote a song. And it's turned into a beautiful collaborative effort. The sound of reconciliation, perhaps.
Today's program was a difficult one for me to put together. And I appreciate those of you who have stayed with me through the process. Actually, it was easy to put together. It was very difficult to relive those memories. It didn't start out as an hour of reflection on the disparity that still thrives across our nation between the haves and have-nots. And it just grew from those memories. I've been surrounded by United Church clergy in my family who deny there's a problem or that it has been dealt with adequately. However, I vehemently disagree. When the Indigenous folk who have been herded onto reservations that were largely useless tracts of land, until, of course, the discovery of resources beneath those lands, do not have potable water, let alone decent opportunities to live a healthy life, and are often driven to drugs and alcohol to mitigate the pain of existence. I and any other human with a heart that beats ought to be absolutely outraged and actively exhorting our federal and provincial governments to wean themselves from corporatism and focus a bit more of their budgets toward their constituents. We are all accountable for this discrepancy if all we do is like postings on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, whatever. There are two more offerings I'd like to share with you. One by the iconic Buffy St. Marie called You Got to Run, and a recitation and song from Tom Jackson from One Arrow Reserve in Saskatchewan. Here's Buffy first with Tanya Tagak. What a treasure Buffy has become, and into her 70s, she's still as active and proactive as ever. Love her. Tom Jackson is well known for his filmology and TV appearances, but maybe best for his Christmas concerts entitled Huron Carol. Jackson has received almost every possible award for his music, acting, and philanthropy, including a Juno Humanity Award in 2007, a Governor General's Award for the Performing Arts for his contribution to Canadian culture, the Order of Canada, and the Queen's Gold and Diamond Jubilee Awards. My son Chris toured Tom when Chris was driving tour buses for the performing arts folk, and Mr. Jackson was a stellar client, he says. Here is Tom. I'm just saying we could put an end to war. Could end war, not peace, not war, eh? Now you've been listening to Words from the Heart. on DTMM and CQBS FM 93.7, the voice of your choice. The memories I have of my travels across North America have not all been happy and pleasant. I've seen too much of the misery of the marginalized and disadvantaged on both sides of the border, and I've shed my share of tears. I abhor the ignorance and shrugging of shoulders of so many who just don't get it, and I hope today's output will have a positive effect on all our behaviors and visions. This is the Bird Dog and Mr. Fix-It going us away, moving and grooving. Please perform at least one random act of kindness every day. It's never too soon to be kind, because one never knows when soon will be too late. Happy Thanksgiving to our American neighbors. Have a great week and a safe one. We'll see you back here in 7 days.